This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Ciudad Juarez was at one time Mexico's deadliest city, while its neighbor on the other side of the border, El Paso, Texas, was considered the safest city in the U.S. Juarez is not as dangerous as it used to be, thanks to the work and cooperation of law enforcement on both sides of the Rio Grande. Thomas More College Associate Professor Dr. James Camp focuses on the two cities in his Mexican-U.S. Border Studies program. He's also taken groups of students to the area to work with local residents. Dr. Camp and former Border Studies student Emily Buchanan talk about the history and culture along the border in El Paso and Juarez. James and Emily, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Now, James, tell us how the city of Juarez was founded. I mean, what's the history of that town?
Well, you have to go back at least 20,000 years to some of the indigenous individuals that migrated into that area and inhabited that area. There are lots of different archaeological sites in that region that indicate that that's been inhabited for very, very, very long time. Fast forward to the 1500s, and there were conquistadors, particularly Juan de Oñate, came into that region from the south with his band of other conquistadors and other individuals, and they needed to cross what was at that point a big river called the Rio Grande, or the Rio Bravo, as it's called on the Mexican side, and they found a place where the rocks were. It was shallow and there were rocks, and that was the pass, and that was the beginning of El Paso. And it was where two mountains came together, the Franklin Mountains to the north and the Juarez Mountains to the south. And you have the Juan de Oñate crossing, and that's part of where the current border of the United States and Mexico is today. And we take our students to visit that particular site. It's actually El Paso. The entire region mm-hmm. was El Paso on both sides of the river. In 1846, at the end of the Mexican-American War and the signing of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, that established that modern border that we have today. And at that point, the city to the north of the river was called Franklinville, after the Franklin Mountains, and the city to the south was called El Paso.
Go ahead. I was wondering, who was Juarez named after?
Benito Juarez was the first, and as far as I'm as far as I know, the only indigenous president of Mexico. He was the president of Mexico in the 1860s during the Civil War in the United States, and at one point in time, the French had occupied Mexico, and he retreated to Ciudad Juarez, what was at that point El Paso, and set up his government there. When the Civil War in the United States concluded, Lincoln and his administration came to the aid of the Mexicans to expel the French from the occupation. And at that point in time, again, a few years later, the city became Ciudad Juarez.
Now, how close are the two cities?
When I take my students down there and we're in a homeless shelter, someone with a very good arm could take a fairly decent sized stone, throw it about 10 or 12 times, and it's in Mexico.
So the only it's a very tiny part of the Rio Grande that's separating the two.
It's interesting if you want to look at the river itself in terms of how it divides the two countries. It's walled in concrete to keep it from moving. The river moves. It's a living thing. And so to establish that boundary between the two, they set it in concrete. At one point in time, it's interesting if you look at the history, there's a place called the Chamizal, which is an international park. There's part of it in Juarez. There's part of it in El Paso. And the river moved. And so there was some dispute over the territory. Mexico claiming part of the United States at one point, and at the same time, the United States claiming part of the area that is now in Mexico. And so in 1964, if I'm not mistaken, they established a treaty defining what those boundaries would be. And so on the United States side, they established the Chamizal Park, and in Mexico, they established the Chamizal Park.
What's the terrain like around these two cities?
It's rugged. It's beautiful in its own way. The mountains are certainly not like the mountains that we would envision. Very few trees, but it's interesting.
Is it a desert area?
It's very arid, very arid. It has a beauty of its own. It is hard to describe.
Emily, what's day-to-day life? You've been in this area. What's day-to-day life like for the people in these
For El Paso
towns?
Or for Juarez?
Both.
It varies. So, yeah. I mean, in El Paso, there's different parts. You can be in more of the corporate side, and you see a lot of people walking around in suits and things. But then you can go to other parts, and you see a lot of Latino people and a lot of white people, just a lot of blue-collar workers. And then when you go to Juarez, it really changes. Even though that they're only a stone's throw away from each other, the buildings, the roads are not taken care of as well as in the United States. There's a lot more people on Juarez side. And it's funny, when we were talking about the river, when you cross over the border, when you're walking across, like where the cars go and things, you're walking over a ditch that doesn't have any water in it. And you're saying, this is Rio Grande?
Really?
It's not very grande, but yeah, it's very nice.
What's been the problem they've had in Juarez with violence? Is that a result of drug cartels, drug trafficking?
Primarily the violence issue that has plagued Juarez for a very, very long time is associated with the drug trade. And, fortunately in the last 3-4 years that violence has subsided. It reached a peak in 2008, 2009, 2010. And we were very blessed as a college to be able to continue to visit at least one particular site in Ciudad Juarez when we would go down there on our trips. It was a women's cooperative, and I felt very strongly about being able to continue to have those visits, simply because that's a community that needs a voice, and they need someone to acknowledge that they are still there, that they are still in need of a hearing. And so I feel very privileged that we were able to continue to visit that, despite the fact that many other schools and understandably restricted travel. We were very, very careful to go straight in, straight out, but at least visit these compounds where these women would meet together in solidarity to produce items to help make a living, but it was also a spiritual center, cultural center, and so forth.
Now, El Paso, it's the opposite, isn't it? That's viewed as one of the safest places you can be in the country, right?
It is. I mean, if you look at and frequently, when I take my students down there, parents are rightfully concerned. You know, when you see what the media says about the region, El Paso statistically is a very safe city. And that's usually when I would meet with parents to discuss the safety measures that we've taken. I would bring up the FBI Uniform Crime Report and say, look, you know, here's El Paso. Here are the statistics on El Paso. It's a very safe city. And part of that is because of the uniformed presence there. You have ICE agents, you have Border Patrol agents, you have state and local police, you have the military. There are lots and lots of individuals there walking around in uniform.
Now, James, tell me about the role of the region as far as economic production, and what effect has NAFTA had on the region?
Wow, that's a big question. The short of it is this, is that in Ciudad Juarez, there are, at its peak, there were about 200 what are called maquiladoras, which are assembly plants. And so frequently planes are flying into El Paso, then materials are unloaded off those planes onto trucks. Those trucks are driven over into Ciudad Juarez. Materials are taken to these maquilas, and they are assembled by labor in Mexico. And then those finished products, those assembled products, are put back on trucks and then brought back into the United States. All kinds of different products, automotive products, pharmaceutical products, electronics, all kinds of different products. And so that's a part of the economic driving engine in Ciudad Juarez is the maquila industry.
Emily, how mm-hmm. dependent, how interdependent would you say these two cities are on each other?
I mean, you can't talk about one without talking about the other, in my opinion. They're very interconnected.
Mm-hmm. James, how much do you see in terms of an interconnection between these two cities?
It's interesting when you ask a question like that El Pasoans for quite some time, especially, you know, beginning with the peak in violence in Ciudad Juarez in 2008, this is a border culture. You have individuals on both sides, families on both sides, individuals crossing back and forth. And there is a tremendous amount of connection of individuals. I've met many times Border Patrol agents who are Latino, who have family, who are Mexican. And you have this connection between these two cities. The part of what's interesting in that particular region is that the flow and the perception that there are so many individuals that are crossing without documents is simply not true. The border enforcement is very effective. Of course, what we hear about are the exceptions to the rule, but there has to be a rule for there to be an exception to the rule. I've seen statistics as low as 1%. 1% of border crossings are those individuals without documents. And all one need do is open their eyes and look to see the amount of traffic and the flow of individuals, trucks, people across those borders. I've waited as long as 3 hours in Sierra Juarez to cross back into the United States. Very, very long lines coming back into the United States. I mean, it's a tremendous traffic going back and forth across those borders.
And so this region is, it's a microcosm, isn't it, of a lot of larger issues, global issues and economic issues, isn't it?
As I was driving over here this morning, I'm listening to NPR, and several times in the presentation that I was listening to, I heard the word migration. And of course, right now we're looking at the issues that are going on in the Middle East and in Europe. There are parallels here with regard to the migration issue. This is a region of the country or a region of the world that is a metaphor for the larger first world, developing world, developed world dynamic that's going on. El Paso and Ciudad Juarez is one of the few places in the world where you have the developing world right up against the developed world. And so there it is a land of contrast. There are all kinds of different contrasts in that region, yes.
A very multicultural area?
It's its own culture. I mean, it truly is. It's very difficult to describe, I think, the allure of that place. I mean, it's a place of contrast where you see pain. You see joy, you see hope, you see anguish frequently when I take my students down there. And we literally live in a homeless shelter while we're there for undocumented migrants. Journal after journal after journal entry, I'm reading about the confusion that my students have with regard to the fortitude of these individuals. You know, that they're in a homeless shelter, they're in a place where their future is not secure, yet they're able to look you in the eye, they're able to have a conversation with you, they are able to welcome you into the house where they live. And I'd like to believe that if we could learn some lessons from those kinds of individuals, maybe we would have a little bit more peaceful of a world.
Emily, give me some of your impressions of this area.
Well, I'll talk about the homeless shelter. So when we go to the homeless shelter, you see nothing but children playing, laughter, food around the table, everybody enjoying themselves. And then you talk to them and you hear their stories about why they're here. And you hurt for them and you think, just like Dr. Camp was saying, how is this hope here when there's so much anguish? And so that's what it's like in the homeless shelter. Very communal. Everything is shared.
What would you say is the biggest lesson, the biggest thing you've learned out of taking part in this?
Well, really, it just changed who I am, honestly. I went to the border at a critical point in my life. I was just coming into college, been in college for a year, and trying to find myself. And there's a quote from Gandhi that I really like, and it's, I think it's something about you find yourself when you lose yourself in the service of others. And so that really made me who I am today and changed my worldview. Mm-hmm.
James, why did you decide to create this course? I mean, you've touched on a lot of the reasons so far, but I mean, what were your specific ideas when you said, I'm going to create a course about two specific border towns?
Well, the truth of the matter is I inherited it. The students at Thomas More created the program. I was invited to go as a chaperone. I went down there as a tag-along, and within about 24 hours, I started to realize the educational opportunities that existed in that area. And as a result of that, I developed a course, and we're now entering our 16th year of doing that. We started in 2000. I spent a year-long sabbatical there, living in the homeless shelter where we served from 2007 to 2008. So there's 1 year where we didn't have the program, but it's been every spring break since 2000, with the exception of that 1 year.
Does this region serve as a good teaching tool?
Well, the whole world's a good teaching tool, depending on how you approach it. This particular area, it's very difficult to deny, you know, the contrast and some of the lessons. It's a little harder to dig in other places than it is to dig there. It's very fertile soil for teaching.
Emily had a good reaction, said this was life-changing. Do the other students see it the same way?
Well, service learning's an art. I continue to work on that, you know, the refinement of that art. I chose her for a reason. I figured that she might say what she said. I'm still working on transformation of the rest of my students. You know, that's part of the goal of teaching, is to make us better people.
Now, what do you think is in the future for Juarez? Is this an area that's going to continue to improve, or is it still going to struggle with violence like it has?
The borderlands ebb and flow. They ebb and flow. They go back and forth. It is a region of wounds, healing, opening of wounds again. It's making me mindful of a quotation from Gloria Anzaldúa, and how there never seems to be this closure, this reckoning in this region. It's under constant transformation. One of the things that has always struck me about that region is the strength of the individuals who live there, that occupy what is, in many people's view, a very harsh place. I mean, to be there, for example, in a sandstorm is a rough thing. I mean, it takes a certain kind of individual. And I think that builds a certain character, you know, in a person, to allow them to weather not only sandstorms, but other kinds of storms that life puts in front of you.
How has Juarez tried to fix its image?
They've been pretty aggressive in terms of trying to re-promote tourism in the region. And that's going to be to only, you know, certain degrees of success. I mean, it's very difficult to deny the violence and the hardship that individuals have endured there. Honestly, I'm at a loss as to how they're going to repair that. I mean, there is an uptick in terms of the image of the city. Back in the early 2000s, we would go over there, and they had a market that we would go and visit and sit out and have some food and listen to mariachis and enjoy the sun. And after 2008, they boarded that up. You know, and you would drive past it in a van or on a bus, and it's like, wow, this is a ghost town in some regards. But the reality is that the people of Ciudad Juarez were still there. You know, it's just that the individuals were not crossing, you know, to frequent the markets and bring their dollars there.
What do you think is going to be the thing that ultimately saves this town?
That's a tough question that I honestly don't know the answer to. How do you repair an image, you know, that is so marred by that kind of violence is really a tough one. I honestly don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah, it doesn't help too. I think there's still a travel warning for Americans. Is there not?
There has been one for quite some time. Yes, and it's not gonna. I don't think that's gonna change anytime soon.
Do you find, Emily? Did you find your heart going out to these folks in Juarez when you were visiting that area?
Most definitely. When we went to the Women's Cooperative, as Dr. Camp was talking about earlier, You see these women who live in poverty and just have really pure souls, and they want to work, but there is no work. And so they're able to come to this place, work, and make a living for themselves when their kids can go to school, they can have spiritual outreach. And when you see those people with great souls, you can't help but you have your heart go out to them.
So ultimately, what message do you want people to take away from this course?
I think individuals need to reckon with the reality that we don't exist in a vacuum, that we exist in a community. We exist as a globe, and to be a little bit more mindful of that connectedness and to draw from the lessons that people on the border are trying to give us, and that is to look each other in the eye, welcome each other, to work on the constant project of being better people.
James and Emily, thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thomas More College Associate Professor Dr. James Camp and former Border Studies student Emily Buchanan.